Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here, back with you for another week here for the week of Friday, February 16th of the year 2018. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's glad to be back with you for a consecutive week here, 2 weeks in a row of doing programs, and given the kind of roller coaster nature of our release schedule so far in 2018. It's a monumental accomplishment, but the bumps and delays should be ironed out by this point, and hopefully going forward, it's just smooth sailing the rest of the way for you.
Indeed, and I am the other voice on this sometimes erratic podcast. This week I'm Dennis, the man who is done with this cold and what it does to his car. No... Not a sickness cold, but weather cold.
Winter finally getting to you?
Well, to my car anyways, yes. My poor, poor car.
It can do that. Winter is very unkind towards automobiles.
That's, yeah. It was, you know, bizarrely warm yesterday, and then bizarrely cold today, and then, you know, I was at work for a full 8 hours, eight and a bit hours, actually, including lunch and whatnot. But, yeah, forgot to go out and start my car up. And when I went to go start it up, it was cold as hell. It was super stuttery and just basically, you know, wasn't very happy. And when I would try to drive it, it would go at idle speed and I'd give it gas and it would not raise from idle speed. So there was definitely something too cold to work properly going on.
And I can see how that would be problematic.
Yeah, so I ended up just kind of like letting it warm up for about 20 minutes, and then it was still having the same problem, and then weirdly enough, I turned the car off and turned it back on, and everything seemed fine. So I'm just going to chalk this up to the cold being a huge jerk.
That's the only thing I can think of off the top of my head. I assume the cold did something to the computer system of the car, and therefore it just couldn't properly regulate the necessary systems of your automobile to give you a pleasant ride. Because the cold does that. The cold does not care about you, your car, or anything else of that nature. The cold just does what it can to freeze you to death.
Yes, the cold is going to wreck your day.
I found myself the other day, when it became very cold after the very pleasant day, the one pleasant day we've had in the past several weeks, after that it became very cold again, as you did say, and I had to, clean off my car to head out to the airport, and, I found that even just in those few minutes where I was outside brushing off the small amount of accumulated snow that I was getting brain freeze. Why? Well, because I wear glasses, and the glasses, of course, sit on the sinus region of your face and are great conductors of cold because they are metal frames.
Yes. Oh, the weird things that happen when you live in a place as cold as Winnipeg, Manitoba.
And it's just unceasingly cold. It's not going to get better. Unfortunately, I think we have to declare from now, we will never know the warmth of sun ever again.
Yeah. I mean, having, you know, just a nice warm breeze across your face, it's gone for us. It's just never going to happen ever again.
Generations will go by without ever knowing the warmth of the sun again. Children will hear tales from their ancestors of being able to walk outside in shorts and just stroll along in summertime and
without dying immediately of frostbite.
And the children will sit gathered around the multiple fires just in awe of the tales that their elders have to tell.
It's the multiple fires, space heater, perhaps a radiator as well, because we don't know how much colder it's going to keep getting, but, you know, maybe they'll have a couple of furnaces running at the same time. Maybe they'll start up one of those styrofoam gasoline fires because they just keep burning forever.
Never again will we know what it's like to have water in liquid form.
It's true.
Such is the plight of our people in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Oh, man.
Now, we exaggerate, we carry on, but good God, it's cold, and it's just not going to change.
No, not for quite some time. Not generations, but at least a few months. And it's, yeah.
Which feels like an eternity.
It sure does. Now, having said that, I'm not looking forward to the crushing heat that we also have to face in summertime, because it gets stupidly hot as well. But at least that only lasts for a few weeks, as opposed to the winter, which just seems to go on forever.
This is true, and
which begs the question, why did we all settle here? Why do we all still live here? What the hell is going on? What's wrong with all of us?
That's a good question. I don't think science has an answer for that yet. Science, anthropologists, sociologists, I mean, presumably we all have family that live in Winnipeg, Manitoba, but, you know, there's nothing to preclude us from picking up and moving to other parts of the world that have warmer climates in the winter months.
It's true. That is true indeed.
And yet here we are. We just don't do it. So it's on one of those, you know, I'll get to it lists that we never ultimately get to.
Or, that sounds like a lot of work. Meh. One of those lists. We all have one of those lists. It's less a list
and more just a... Do we? Because it seems like a lot of work to make that list.
Yeah. It's less a list and more just a stray thoughts and meanderings that never have any sort of tangible outcomes that come to fruition.
And like, oh, it'd be nice one day if...
But that and if never has any sort of... It. Yeah, exactly.
So instead we are forced to, seek shelter as best we can and, take refuge near as many space heaters as possible, blankets, some sort of, animal fur or faux animal fur, as many layers as possible. I don't think I've ever worn my long johns as much as I have this winter.
Yeah, same. Same indeed.
And not to say, you know, make it sound like I'm some outdoors adventurer who's going snowshoeing every day and thus needs the, you know, to contain the warmth in his legs. No, I'm wearing them when I go, like, outside and driving in the mornings and the car's cold, and I'm wearing them when I'm still at work.
Yeah. Me too. I walk from my back door to my garage, get in my car, and freeze my ass off while wearing my long johns. For my 15-minute drive to work, then I walk from my car to the office, and then, yeah, still, totally worth wearing the long johns.
Yeah, there's nothing to be gained about trying to present yourself as brave and being able to endure the cold with less layers. No, you layer up as much as you can, and... Even when your legs warm up, say if you're in a nice warm office, or building or whatever the case may be, you find you still keep the long johns on just because your legs are warm and you just like that feeling.
Yep, exactly. Plus, why would you bother taking it off? Like, you'll just have to put them back on again anyways.
That's true. That's very true. Which then begs the question, why take them off at all?
Yeah. That's a little idea I've been tinkering with myself. But before we get there, we do have, and before we keep going on this tangent about long johns and how cold it is and all that stuff, we do have an actual show that we should probably get into here.
Yeah, that we actually did plan out. We did not plan out a whole show about long johns, though we'll save that topic for a different podcast.
It's sounding more and more like we have a whole other podcast that we could do surrounding this topic, but...
It's at least one episode, if not a multi-part series.
Yeah. Indeed.
Let us get into the meat and potatoes of the show we have planned out for you. And it's another jam-packed show this week, much as last week's was. But we did find time on this week's episode to squeeze in not one, but two ludicrous leadoffs. They've been missing for the past couple of weeks, but we have two of them here for you now. And the first one, a surprising one, not really a story you hear too often. We live in a day and age where Seemingly anything is ripe for a remake, re-release, remastering, simply as a means of cashing in on people's nostalgia. And oftentimes, the item, be it a movie, or, you know, in the case of our podcast, a video game, those things are pretty much represented as they were for full nostalgic value. You really don't hear too often of someone going back and actually doing work on an old piece of entertainment, like a video game, because once it's just kind of out there, it's out there. That is how it's going to look and exist until the end of time.
Yeah, that's sort of, you know, always how it's been, at least for those of us that grew up kind of with earlier iterations of video games. That usually was the case. You would buy your cartridge, you would buy your CD, you would buy whatever. And, you know, your video game console back in the day never had an internet connection. An internet connection was actually not really that widespread of a concept yet. So you would just have the game, and if there were bugs, if there were weird quirks, those just became part of the charm of the game.
They were, and they just lived on with the game, and then became discussion points on message boards, blogs, and whatever else, and various and sundry write-ups or listicles as our new internet age took hold. And yet we have an actually surprising story, which came out a week and a bit ago, and it stemmed from an interview that Eurogamer did with a man named John Burton, who was the founder of Traveler's Tales Games. And Eurogamer was talking to Mr. Burton about the fact that he, about his long career in video games, because he was the founder of Traveler's Tales, but it was during that interview that he released and spoke of a very surprising nugget of information that he's gone back and created a director's cut for an old video game. He's gone back and done the work and actually released it to the public. You can get your hands on it, and we have links to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com. And he's released his own patch of things he wanted to fix and whatever else for Sonic 3D Blast.
Yeah, which is super strange and not something that you would necessarily think would ever happen. But, yeah, Sonic 3D Blast. Yeah. It's like, yeah, Burton had like a big, basically like was talking to Eurogamer, basically almost like, about almost like a career kind of retrospective thing, but he basically set this whole thing up with, you know, how he was talking about how when Traveler's Tales, the studio began to kind of expand, Burton kind of stepped more into a creative director type role, but since then he's sort of like removed himself from the games industry, and, you know, he's kind of like these days taking a more fresh look at his portfolio with, you know, fresh non-in-the-moment eyes, just kind of more looking back in a retrospective kind of way. And he says that, like, while he definitely is proud of all of his work that he did with Traveler's Tales, he was essentially just saying he's basically seen some, like, in going through and playing old games, he's basically noting some bugs and stuff that, like, he now wants to fix. And then couple that with the fact that ROM hacks are sort of commonplace now, he kind of saw an opportunity to kind of do it this way, which is kind of brilliant.
And not something that you would necessarily think of, or perhaps anyone would think be possible for an older game. Now, there's the caveat that this is available through Steam, so you do have to own a copy of the game first.
Yeah. Or at the very least, you need to have some kind of thing. Yeah, it's available through the Steam Workshop. But there's also a Dropbox download, which is kind of a hilarious thing as well. But, Yeah, he basically, in further talking about this very interesting project, he says, as game developers get older, these issues are going to come up more and more. I don't think that there's anything in my past that anybody's really going to clamor to see, but I think a lot of developers do, and if they've left these companies, can they legally do it? I think there's negotiation that has to technically take place here.
And that's him discussing the, I guess, legal ramifications of this, because not necessarily can every developer just go back and rework on, have access to the assets for, or release something new pertaining to an old game that they've previously worked on and developed for, because those rights and those licenses, those assets, just everything to do with that IP would be contained at the studio they worked for.
Yeah. But yeah.
And if you're just a developer, then you really don't have much claim to it. But because, John Burton was the, founder and, you know, high ranking official of, Traveler's Tales Games when Sonic 3D Blast was made, he was in charge of the studios. So he has more legal claim to these things than some lower ranking people who worked on it at the time.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure. Just the development community should be kind of glad for this in general. Not just this, but all of the other stuff that John Burton seems to be doing. Because he also, yeah, according to Eurogamer, the interview with Eurogamer, he says that he's actually, now that he's done this, he's going to return to YouTube, where he has his own channel set up that he says is mostly for his own amusement, where he just, you know, uses it to upload prototypes and talk about coding practices that he developed years and years ago. And I quote, "They get hundreds of thousands of views, me waffling on about old technology in a bad British accent. It's a selfish endeavor, but if people enjoy it, that's all the better." End quote.
So an interesting avenue to learn about old coding or old coding practices for the video games gone by.
Yeah, and really, I feel that especially now with the resurgence of retro gaming, some of these old coding and or just other ideas like sprite animation or just maybe some old ideas can probably come back, you know, with modern glasses through what, you know, the technology that we have available now, and see how you can maybe apply some old ideas in a far easier way. Maybe it's just, it's very exciting to see someone from back in the day kind of open up about back in the day. It's just, it's like a less boring version of a history textbook.
Is it technically possible to utilize some old code or old coding practices in today's developing landscape with, you know, newer coding languages that didn't exist back then and newer technologies, which of course didn't exist back then, to develop something?
Well, not specific lines of code, but algorithms can be reused, and certainly, and, you know, just different, like, logical ideas can certainly be reused, like, There's stuff that John Carmack developed for Doom way back in the day that actually made it to computer science textbooks and stuff and are still sort of being taught, which is surprising that something like Doom could have that, but yeah, just, I feel that like old computer games and old video games are probably a lot richer of a resource than a lot of us maybe make them out to be. In terms of like what they can kind of show us for technology, because really what other types of programs in computer software from the commercial side of things was really pushing boundaries and graphics and like performance and stuff.
Yeah, that would have come from the video game side of things, as there was the arms race back in the day to, have the best graphics that technology would allow for.
Yeah. And well, not just best graphics, but also like best graphics with good performance. Cause you know,
true.
Like, but yeah, anyways, without me
watching. And also gameplay experience.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's not like as revolutionary as a lot of Microsoft products and Office products and whatever other kind of productivity software was, and as important as there are concepts in those as well, I feel that like they push maybe other less exciting boundaries. And yeah, I don't know. There's just something satisfying about, you know, a software developer to be able to see like stuff that you did come to life as opposed to just stuff that you did boringly get typed into.
No, I can see that. And not only that, the end product is something people actually go and play with rather than something they have to just trudge through and use for mundane work.
Yeah, exactly. But,
no, I totally get it. But hey, speaking of, coding and developing, I think one of the, more interesting uses of coding we've seen, recently has been to enable all these, the burgeoning field of, live and game streaming platforms, most notably, that being Twitch. And if we're talking, coding and developing, I'd imagine there's a lot of coding and developing that went into making Twitch Plays Pokemon possible.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a very ingenious marriage of about three or four different seemingly disparate technologies. But, you know, once you see them all tied together, it makes perfect sense. You know, you have like the Twitch API, the Twitch chat API, which is, you know, as a developer, you can kind of, if you have a development or an access key with a token and all that stuff, you can basically, it's my understanding that you can programmatically subscribe to a chat and then basically get a real-time stream of access to everything that's typed into that chat. And then once you have that connection made, you can start basically filtering out things that you want from the chat and then send those keystrokes and whatever else somewhere else. And what Twitch Plays Pokemon did was basically made a bridge from that output stream to an input stream of, you know, a Game Boy emulator. And, yeah, it is really impressive. It sounds kind of simplistic in theory, but I'm sure in execution it was a little bit harder than that, especially since they introduced like polling mechanisms and basically voting on like, which buttons actually get pressed and like whatnot. But, yeah, we've been, it might seem like we've been talking about Twitch Plays Pokemon for a long time at this point. And, because we kind of have, it's been going on for about 4 years now, believe it or not. And, they're going to be celebrating actually their 4-year anniversary right away, and they're doing something kind of crazy to do it.
They are. It's something crazy, but it's also really impressive. They're going kind of back to the start, because when Twitch Plays Pokemon first became a phenomena, it was users watching and streaming Pokemon being played on Twitch, but it was the first of the Game Boy games that was released in North America. It was just one of them. But as anyone who was around back then can recall, there was actually two original Game Boy games available at the time. There was Red and Blue. Of course, you made your selection, and if you chose anything other than Blue, you were wrong. And
I disagree, but carry on.
I respect your right and ability to disagree. However, that still makes you wrong.
I'll just say Charizard is better than Blastoise, but, you know, that's neither here nor there, I suppose.
Well, doesn't water be fire, though?
Yeah, but you play with fire, you're going to get burned.
That is not really a positive.
Fire's cooler than water? And don't bring up Don't even bring up the fact that one Squirtle wore sunglasses in the TV show. That was just, anyways, continue.
So what they're doing now to celebrate the 4th anniversary is Twitch Plays Pokemon, instead of being focused on just one single copy of Pokemon, instead it's going back to its roots, and now users, viewers, streamers, and participants in Twitch Plays Pokemon can follow along as the original two Pokemon games are being played at the same time. Now, if you thought Twitch Plays Pokemon was madness before, multiply that by another game.
Yeah, no. No, granted, they are technically the same game, but you can imagine, as an RPG that has random battles and everything, how quickly everything will get totally out of sync. Especially when you have to press up or down or left or right to navigate menus on one screen while a battle's happening. What's going to happen on the other screen while no battle's happening?
This is true. And as we recall back in the day, there were different preferences for games for either the red or blue version back in the day. So some people gravitated towards the red copy. Some people gravitated towards the blue copy. So not always will there be an equal amount of interest in both games. But somehow, as it happens, you're right. The games have not progressed equally. When we first came across the story at the time that happened, the red copy of Pokemon, that stream was a bit further along, having acquired 2 badges, and apparently there's been issues already with the red copy glitching out and the player turning into just a mess of code and broken images on screen. But they're not as terribly far off as you might think. But, I mean, that could have changed. As we sit here recording, of course, it's unfolding elsewhere on the internet, so we aren't watching it providing live commentary. That would just be ridiculous, although an interesting challenge, but still ridiculous. And you can certainly watch it for yourself. We do provide a link to it, again, on our website, thearcadeshow.com. And, yeah, two games at the same time. They're being treated as different games, even though fundamentally they are the exact same game, but it's two different games.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting challenge, and once this concludes, I wonder if there's going to be any other Twitch plays out there which take this idea and go with two perhaaps completely separate, different games just to see what the mashup might bring.
Yeah, or how much of a mess or how terrible it's going to be. Like, I'm expecting a Dark Souls mixed with some other completely other disparate game, or maybe two Dark Souls games, or maybe Bloodborne and Dark Souls or something. I'm not sure, but regardless, that's the ludicrous leadoffs, I'd say.
It is, and that one of Twitch Plays Pokemon reminds me of the story we came across towards the end of 2017 with the one streamer fellow who was attempting to play 3 Final Fantasy games at the same time.
Yes. I don't remember what came of that, or if we remembered actually to check up on that, but yeah, that concept is not brand new. Still, I've heard about that concept sort of happening a few times here and there, and good luck to everyone who's involved in that, and I'd actually be surprised to see which game actually finishes first.
True, that, and see what the teams end up like and just how the characters, the Pokemon themselves, develop and progress. And of course, Twitch Plays Pokemon has democracy mode, which can just throw things absolutely out the window, or perhaps turn them on their ear. And I'm also curious to see how long it takes for these things to finish.
Yeah, that's also a good question.
But we'll keep along and follow along with them and let you know in the future what comes of these Twitch Plays Pokemon dual stream 4th anniversary event. But one item we spoke of a lot, especially towards the end of 2017 and recapped on our year interview shows, was loot boxes really becoming a loathed term and loathed item in the video game sphere.
Yeah. They're pretty much no one likes them. If you like loot boxes, you're only, like, you're a corporation. You're the only type of entity that likes them, and you're the corporation that's making money off them. No one actually likes them. they just kind of bring out the same kind of bad impulses in people as gambling does. And a lot of lawmakers, as you may have heard us talk about this a lot last year, a lot of lawmakers sort of feel the same way and, you know, are actually trying to do something about it. But in particular, a few people or a few lawmakers have been kind of more on the ball than others, as it seems. For example, one of the first is Washington State Senator Kevin Ranker, who has introduced a bill that seeks to answer whether or not loot boxes should definitively be considered as gambling or not. And in his bill, Ranker had explained to the Washington News, the Washington-based News Tribune, not the Washington News, is that it's to task state officials and game developers with determining whether mechanics like loot boxes are a form of gambling that preys on children. Specifically, he wants them to determine if loot boxes are considered gambling under Washington law, if such mechanics belong in games and apps, if minors should have access to games that feature loot boxes, and if game developers should be more transparent and disclose the odds of random chance microtransactions. Which sounds pretty reasonable to me.
And not only that, the bill that Kevin Ranker, or Senator Ranker, is proposing would require the State Gambling Commission in the state of Washington to conduct a study on the use of loot box mechanics in video games and then provide lawmakers recommendations on how best to regulate loot boxes, such as options for a regulatory and enforcement system or restrictions on the sale of games containing such mechanics. As Senator Ranker told the News Tribune, quote, what the bill says is, industry, state, sit down to figure out the best way to regulate this. It's unacceptable to be targeting our children with predatory gambling masked in a game with dancing bunnies or something. End quote. An interesting little analogy there. Ranker notes that he'd like to see developers disclose the odds for chance-based purchases to protect younger players from the temptation to overspend on random chance items. But ultimately, as he explained to the News Tribune, his line of thinking is that if it looks like gambling, it should be regulated like gambling.
Yeah. But it seems like lawmakers in Hawaii are maybe taking an even harder line approach to this, because they've proposed a series of bills, actually, that target the sale of loot boxes in video games. Two of the bills, according to Hope Corrigan of IGN.com, claim that, if passed, would stop sales of games in which players under the age of 21 can use real money to buy randomized rewards. Though it's not actually clear how it would be regulated. And, another set of the bills would see games with purchasable loot boxes or other random rewards feature labels to disclose as well as display the probability rates for prizes. So the same thing that Ranker is proposing in Washington. Interestingly enough, one of the state representatives, Chris Lee, happens to be a longtime gamer, who revealed last year that he and others were looking into this legislation. He says now, and I quote, I've watched firsthand the evolution of the industry from one that seeks to create new things to one that's begun to exploit people, especially children, to maximize profit. It's a $30 billion industry. It's bigger than Hollywood. It's an industry that can reach into everyone's pockets and phones and consoles and PCs, but there's no authority to force them to disclose their practices. End quote.
And the Hawaiian state representative, Chris Lee, was actually one of the first American politicians to come out and make definitive declarative statements on their view of loot boxes in the wake of the Star Wars Battlefront 2 loot box brouhaha. And the recurring theme we're hearing is protecting children and also clarity on the odds and disclosure of the odds before purchases can be made and just offer that information to the consumer. But that's just a state-by-state level. And that's in America, where it most likely will all happen on a state-by-state level because their federal government is completely and irreparably broken. But let's move to some older democracies where they might have their shit together. And in Europe, the German authorities there are looking into loot boxes. Specifically, the German Youth Protection Commission has stated that it's considering a ban on loot boxes after research conducted by the University of Hamburg found too many elements of gambling in video games. This story coming to us from Gamasutra, but the source of it was PCGamer.com. And according to PCGamer, in their report on this, the German Youth Protection Commission is also considering a ban on loot boxes because it might violate laws against promoting gambling to children and adolescents. The Youth Protection Commission will bring down its decision on loot boxes sometime in March, with Chairman Wolfgang Kriebig stating that it's, quote, conceivable that loot boxes violate existing regulation in place to protect children and adolescents. And again, with the necessity of protecting children, but the thing we're also seeing, especially with the Washington state law and the study that would be proposed or asked of the state gaming regulator, is to try and catch the gaming laws up to what loot boxes are.
Yeah. And for the record, I believe that's Wolfgang Kriesig.
I think that, my apologies.
I think that B is actually two S's, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, so I think the main theme I'm seeing here, though, in America, it seems more like something that lawmakers almost have to do just because of the moral pulse of the country, less than Germany, which just genuinely seems concerned, is just basically really bring protecting children into it. Which, yeah, anytime lawmakers say stuff like that in the States, they just kind of seem like they have to tack it on just to, you know, pull at people's heartstrings a little bit more. Whereas in Germany, they just kind of seemed like they were just saying, yeah, these are clearly, like, kids are playing these games. Probably shouldn't let them just spend money willy-nilly.
Yeah, and that's very much what it reads to me like as well. And I think one of the comments I made on our year in review show back in January when speaking about loot boxes is that loot boxes, this topic, this subject, they're really easy for politicians to get out there, talk about, try and score some brownie points, because the people perpetuating them, promoting them, are big billion-dollar companies. They're just pure greed. They're pure just forms of unadulterated greed. So no one's going to be sympathetic to the companies or the industry for things that are simply trying to pry people away from more of their money. But we're seeing it, and I wonder how much it will continue and how many other states will get on the loot box regulation bandwagon. Because if this becomes a patchwork of state regulations where some require disclosure and other states have banned sales of games that contain loot boxes or whatnot, it's going to be a nightmare for, studios and developers to release games that have loot box mechanics.
Yeah, which is probably, in my opinion, probably a good thing. Maybe that's the best we can hope for, that they look at the patchwork and trying to keep, you know, track of all of the different intricacies of each state laws, and then they just throw up their arms and go, never mind, not worth it, let's just release more DLC or something. Or whatever. Like, if there's anything that can possibly come of this, hopefully it's something that steers game companies away from this in one way or shape or another. Like,
now
I don't know if they'll necessarily be successful in policing it, but hopefully just the potential for a bunch of red tape is enough to have people kind of have their head spin and go, oh God, never mind.
Possible. I think too, what we'll see, not only if there's a patchwork of regulations and laws and whatever, but we'll also see states in America that have no regulation whatsoever for loot boxes or these mechanics or whatever. And, for them, just the door is wide open. Come on in. you know, loot box away if that's your thing, because they believe in less regulations, and this is one of the results. So
yes, we call those states international waters.
Ah, good old international waters. How I've missed you. But yeah, there would be a very wide and broad spectrum of laws, labeling, informing consumers across the United States. And we're going to see, I expect we'll see, I should say, more and more of it through the year of 2018. Washington State, Hawaii, getting out there in front. And once those states are in front, and if they actually have laws that come to fruition and get enacted, then it would actually become easier for other states to follow suit, because I'm sure they would just copy and paste the same legislation, just change what you have to, but the same teeth would be in place, wouldn't it, if you want to regulate?
Presumably. But yeah, moving on from, you know, states and laws and real lawmakers and stuff, onto other lawmakers of sorts. You know, maybe not with as much broad sweeping power, but, you know, still some power. Some people, there's one major authority on the internet called Twin Galaxies, which, they can't actually make laws that govern your life or anything and how you are allowed to live your life, but they can govern whether or not you have set a legitimate video game record, and those records are usually in the time of, or in the form of either high scores or most impressive times for things, and they're generally, you know, the kind of the authority on this sort of thing. And normally, whenever you get a record on Twin Galaxies, it's there until the next person beats it, because Twin Galaxies is sort of considered the authority, and their vetting process is very rigorous, and they're normally very anal about making sure that, you know, they're not misrepresenting any sort of genuine achievement, because they just kind of want to make things as fair and legitimate as possible. And, yeah, which is why these couple of pieces of news are kind of shocking that we're about to talk about.
They are, and I guess somewhat fitting that we are currently in the midst of the Winter Olympiad taking place in Pyeongchang, South Korea, where times and scores are very heavily regulated. I mean, these current Winter Games are being conducted somewhat under protest from Russia, with a number of their athletes and records and results being tossed out from the Sochi Olympic Games because of improper conduct and fudging and really just doping. And there's no real doping in video games. And you don't really hear of fixing or faking of achievements in video games really too often. And as you said, in no small part because the Twin Galaxies process is very rigorous, but at the end of January, a controversy erupted when Twin Galaxies removed and disqualified a high score which had stood since 1982. So back then, a man by the name of Todd Rogers purported to set a world record time of 5.51 seconds in the racing game Dragster, which was for the Atari 2600. And it wasn't until 2017, so a good 35 years later, that some people started to actually question and then really look into that high score and try to determine if it was in fact even achievable in the game. And so it started, ultimately went to an arbitration process through Twin Galaxies, because when you're a governing body like that, you need to have an arbitration process to adjudicate these things. And the high score was removed. So in a message on the from the Twin Galaxies staff posted to the Twin Galaxies message boards, quote, "Based on the complete body of evidence presented in this official dispute thread, Twin Galaxies administrative staff has unanimously decided to remove all of Todd Rogers' scores, as well as ban him from participating in our competitive leaderboards. The presented software analysis model concluded that achieving score times of less than 5.57 seconds is not possible under standard and normal play conditions." End quote.
Harsh words. Like, he's not even allowed to compete ever again, it seems like.
That is a serious ban hammer. And Todd Rogers, in this news item we found on Kotaku, is described as a score chaser, or at least was a high score chaser for video games. So that was his thing. And
at least 35 years ago, it was.
It was his thing.
I don't know if it still is necessarily, but regardless, in the investigation, last year, Eric Omnigamer Koziel, he was the one that kind of called the thing into question. And yeah, he was saying that like the fastest achievable time should be 5.5 seconds. And he did this by, you know, creating a tool assisted speed run, as people sometimes do, using edited tools to basically perfectly edit keystrokes with frame perfect precision to basically figure out what the optimal routes and everything that you, or what the optimal keystrokes are to actually do it. And the very, very fastest he was able to do was 5.57, which is a full, you know, 0.06 seconds faster, or yeah, slower, I should say, than the claimed record on file, which does sound suspicious. But yeah. Brutal. 35 years.
35 years. And, not only that, nobody outside of Todd Rogers was ever able to achieve that 5.51 time in Dragster.
Though I did read an interesting comment on the Kotaku, message. Well, in the comment section for the story, because there was also a note at the end of the article, how they were saying that Rogers was not the only one who said he'd logged that same time. And, the quote was basically saying that, like, if there is, well, let me just pull it up here. Yeah, it's like this one person was saying, their username is LL Mern. Limern, I don't know how it's pronounced, but their comment has 64 stars, which means that a lot of people seem to like it. And they say, "I don't have a dog in this fight, but this whole thing strikes me as weird. Activision was satisfied back in the day, and I have a hard time believing a teenager in 1982 would have been able to fake a Polaroid, which I seem to recall was the preferred form of proof for Sega high scores in their magazine later on. Plus, he's not the only person to be credited with that time, so either three people independently decided to fake the same time, or something about modern reproduction attempts is wrong." Which is also a fair point. Maybe emulation isn't as good as we think it is.
True, too. And I guess when this high score came up back in the 1980s, Activision's internal testing gave a theoretical optimal time of 5.54 seconds, but nothing said that 5.51 was impossible or outright never able to be achieved. There were two others in an Activision newsletter who, back in the 1980s, said they achieved the same time of 5.51 seconds, though no one has ever found them, and they've never been able to reproduce that time to anybody's satisfactory knowledge on the Twin Galaxy boards. And the creator of the game, actually, David Crane, spoke to Kotaku last July on this matter and gave, a vote of confidence and said he didn't doubt that Rogers achieved the record using what were the valid methods at the time, and said the same thing to Twin Galaxies last week. But this is an interesting scandal. Can we say it's a scandal? A controversy that has come up in the Twin Galaxy universe, which really doesn't see scandals too often.
Yeah. And, well, actually, like, just to sort of vaguely segue into our next little point here about this, and also to kind of go back and talk to actually how much of an authority Twin Galaxies actually is, because Twin Galaxies stripped the record, in turn, the Guinness Book of World Records has also removed Todd Rogers' record in Dragster from its database as well, just based on the fact that they essentially trust Twin Galaxies implicitly. So that's also a secondary kick in the pants, because, I mean, if you're used to kind of knowing I have the world record in something, I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records. No one can take that away from me. For this to happen, now it's like, well, shit.
Twin Galaxy, actually Guinness World Records, when I guess they were contacted by Kotaku, writer Heather Alexandra about this and what they would do in regards to Todd Rogers' score, they wrote back and said, quote, Twin Galaxies is Guinness World Records' trusted advisor on video game high scores, and as such, we rely on it to monitor high score gaming records and handle any and all disputes that occur within its community. Consequently, we have removed Guinness World Records' title for longest standing video game record from our records database, along with any other records that Mr. Rogers currently holds, and we will continue to partner with Twin Galaxies for further video game record verification, end quote. So that right there, Guinness World Records just turns to Twin Galaxies for all gaming records.
Yeah. Though, personally, I kind of feel that because it was in there for 35 years, doesn't it actually still have the distinction of the longest held video game record? Even if it was like necessarily later found out to be not true, it was still in there for 35 years. Doesn't he get by with a technicality? At least put a footnote in or something? Like,
yeah, an asterisk of some description, although it stops being a record and no longer would hold that place. I can see that argument as well.
Longest false video game record slipping by for 35 years? Like, I don't know.
It was something for 35 years, that's for sure.
Though Rogers actually is a really, really good sport about this, I must say. I mean, if I was him, I'd be pissed, but he doesn't seem pissed. He actually seems a little bit kind of happy about it. And I quote, although I disagree with their decision, I must applaud them for their strong stance on the matter of cheating. While I do maintain that Twin Galaxies is wrong in my particular case, if the investigation into my scores and subsequent banning can serve as a catalyst to clean the database of questionable scores and facilitate methods to catch future cheaters, this is a positive thing. End quote.
And understandably, he would have had every right just to go off on Twin Galaxies and say this is a pile of crap.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, good on him for being a good sport about it, at least. Like,
it is, and I wonder how much of this, too, is or contributing to this is the fact that there really aren't good records kept, good artifacts kept from 1982. I mean, is there a VHS recording of him doing it? I mean, there's nothing from that time of 1982 that is up to the current standards that Twin Galaxy uses to maintain and judge and adjudicate records that are submitted to it.
No, hell, I'd be even surprised if the Polaroid is even still in good condition.
Exactly. And so I wonder if this then is a launching off point to look at and have people review other records that they feel might be in dispute. And actually from this, either because of this or just coincidentally around the same time, longtime arcade or Donkey Kong world high score record holder and just giant douche Billy Mitchell has had one of his Donkey Kong record scores in dispute.
Yeah, called into question. Though it's not fully rescinded yet. And also I feel like there, Twin Galaxies is in a slightly different position with Billy Mitchell, given how much money and funding he's kind of provided them over the years. But yeah, Billy Mitchell's 2010 Donkey Kong record was called into question. I guess Todd Rogers really was the catalyst here, because he specifically mentioned in a blog post on TwinGalaxies.com where they talk about how Billy Mitchell was actually, when he set his record, the accusations that he was using MAME instead of an actual machine, and that the recording was actually done as a screen cap rather than a video of the screen. And also, I don't know the full details of all of the big forum post and everything doing the analysis, but I think they were also commenting on how you can't fully see his hands, which I think is a big no-no when you're going for world record attempts as well, at least with Twin Galaxies. But, yeah. Wouldn't it be a huge kick in the pants if Billy Mitchell was next?
You know, there's part of me that would get some sort of satisfaction from that, if for no other reason than just from what I saw in King of Kong, A Fistful of Quarters, and in appearances after that, Billy Mitchell does himself no favors and seems to do himself no favors and just presents himself as a douche.
Yeah.
He looks like a douche, he sounds like a douche, and he just has a smarmy look about him the whole time.
Yeah, the entire air of Billy Mitchell is one of, look at how great I am, kiss the ring on my finger, you're not even worthy to bask in my greatness, I'm so great. Which, on the one hand, part of me thinks maybe this is kayfabe, but another part of me then snaps back and go, wait a minute, this isn't professional wrestling though. Well, there's no place for kayfabe in real life. That's stupid. That doesn't make any sense. Like there's no drama to be had in real life. Like if there is, it's on you. No one actually wants to engage in drama and like that's insane.
And also too, just, there's always been something about him that has struck me, as making me think that he genuinely takes his arcade high scores seriously. This is a lifetime pursuit for him. It's more than a hobby. It is almost something he will use to define his life by. And there's something tremendously sad about that, but when you take it as seriously then as he does and is as smarmy about it as he is or appears to me to be, that's what makes you a douche in my mind.
Yeah.
It's video game high scores. They're going to be beaten. If you're in a constant pursuit and that's what your life's mission is, good on you, but, you need something else to define your life by.
But I mean, having said that, in my opinion, you can define your life by that. That's fine, but, or you can have that as being a major part of your life, certainly, but, I don't know. Why isn't he, well, maybe he is as proud of his hot sauce business or something. That would also be something to be proud of. Being a successful business person. Fine. Cool. Interesting. But I don't know. To be fair, I also don't know to what degree of the King of Kong was just editing tricks and whatnot. We've all seen, you know, documentaries that have been sort of edited in such a way where someone that maybe isn't necessarily that evil is just kind of made out to be evil because they put certain music cues in or, you know, edit things in a certain way and juxtapose them with conversations by people that maybe are trying out to smear them and stuff. I don't know. But,
or how much of King of Kong 2 was Billy Mitchell just kind of putting on for the cameras.
Yeah. Like actual legitimate kayfabe.
Yeah, and then just he's kept it up because that's the character that was seen and what people know him from is King of Kong. So he's just kind of gone with it, which might explain why he literally wears the same thing anytime he is seen in any sort of large public event where there might be photographs and video taken of him with his black shirt, dark pants, American flag necktie, and hair that looks like it's forming a hood around his head.
Yes. Very strange looking hair. Very weird kind of error about his appearance. But, yeah, I don't know. If there's any sort of positive thing to come of this, maybe it'll finally be, you know, maybe it'll finally be the revelation that Billy Mitchell cheated or something, but I don't know. I feel like there's too much legitimate documented evidence that Billy Mitchell actually is good at Donkey Kong for him to be outright struck out from Twin Galaxies, but who knows? We'll see what happens.
Yeah, true too. And it's kind of wild that Twin Galaxies has been around for this many years, and with an internet component, a very strong and ever-growing internet component, a dedicated base of people interested in the high scores and almost and policing the high scores for these video games. And we haven't really come across something like this before, because in the many years we've been doing this program, be it on radio or podcast, I do not recall seeing a story come across the wire of a disputed Twin Galaxies high score that has been removed. Now, that being said, it's entirely possible there have been ones that we just haven't seen, or ones that were for records that did not stand for 35 years, and thus they weren't as prominent and didn't quite get the mention, but this is a big deal.
Yeah, sure is. But speaking of big deals, there was a brouhaha brewing at Sony last week, or 2 weeks ago now, sorry, because there were some major changes going to be happening at Sony, because Kazuo Kazuhirai decided to step down as their CEO after taking 6 years at his turn at the helm of the company, and he's going to be replaced by their current chief financial officer, Kenichiro Yoshida, at the start of next fiscal year, which is April 1st.
And Kazuhirai, known to most gamers as being the head of the Sony Game Division, or Sony Computer Entertainment America, which he joined in 1995, and eventually was promoted to head of the entire just Sony company, which is a very large multi-tendrilled company, back in April of 2012. So he's not gone immediately. He'll be there as part of a transition for the next several weeks, and his replacement, Kenichiro Yoshida, will take over on April 1st. And at that point, Kazuhirai will transition as to being just a member on the board of directors in a much more relaxed capacity than the CEO of a very large multi-billion dollar corporation.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, like, when you think about other CEOs of, like, equally crazy corporations, can you honestly think of any other CEOs that maybe started out as kind of humbly as he did and create some of, like, some of the properties that he did? Because at his tenure at SCEA, he was kind of responsible for bringing certain key franchises of the time to light, like Jak and Daxter, Ratchet and Clank, and Sly Cooper.
That's true. Those were very recognizable brands that the company established on both the PlayStation 2 and PlayStation 3. And hell, he was there at the helm of the Sony Computer Entertainment of America arm when the PlayStation 2 was launched, and that becoming the absolute phenomena and killer machine that it was for the 10 years it was available.
Yeah. But yeah. So kudos to Kazuhirai, I suppose.
Yeah, he's getting to, I guess, move on after, well, being in the Sony family since 1984. I mean, he's not a programmer or a game person by trade. He started out actually working for Sony Music in Japan in their marketing department, and then just literally climbed his way up from there, climbing the ranks to eventually become CEO, but moving on to become chairman and director of the board of directors in Sony, after the new CFO takes over as CEO, and I believe he cited family reasons and just really wanting to reduce the amount of travel involved in his life, because if you're a CEO of Sony where you have plants and operations all around the world, I don't know how much traveling you're not doing. That's just your life. I mean, you have a private jet and you live a nice life and you drive nice cars and, you know, stay in nice hotels and whatever, but you're literally on the road all the time.
Yeah. And you're probably not very much allowed to take your loved ones with you wherever you go most of the time. So there's that.
That's true. And, being someone who does business travel to a small extent comparatively to the CEO of Sony, yeah, it's hard. Even I find myself looking at some of the more intense frequent flyers who have the, you know, and tags on their suitcases or satchels that just indicate how much more traveling they've done than me. And if it's twice as much, I just look at them and every time I think, I don't know how you do it. Just, I don't know what your life is like. It's insane.
Yeah. It's quite insane. But
Kaz Hirai, not the only game executive, in the news, over the past little bit, over on the Nintendo side of the ledger, some positive news about their longtime hardware wizard who recently retired from the company, Genyo Takeda. It was announced he will be receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences at the DICE Awards event in Las Vegas. That happening, in, I believe, March.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And Genyo Takeda, the name might not ring a bell, but he worked on the hardware side of things. He developed, the N64, the GameCube. He was there at Nintendo for the Wii as well. He was one of the two, right-hand men, if you will, when Tatsuya Kimishima took over as president of Nintendo after Satoru Iwata passed away. Basically, he was working right alongside Shigeru Miyamoto through the birth and growth of Nintendo for many, many years.
Yeah, and his career with Nintendo really didn't start with the N64. It went way back before then. His career began as a lowly developer at Nintendo, developing titles such as Punch-Out, Star Tropics, among many others, way back in the NES days. But, the last position he held at Nintendo until he retired back last year in 2017 was one of his special representatives. The representative directors, whereas Miyamoto was one of them as well. But yeah, he's now retired, though he continues to serve in a corporate advisor kind of role. But yeah, he was honored with lifetime achievement honors from Nintendo because of all the crazy work he's done over the years.
Indeed. I mean, he started with Nintendo back in 1974 before there, you know, was even a home console business. The arcade side of video gaming was still in its infancy. And he just kind of helped bring along Shigeru Miyamoto, who studied under Takeda when Miyamoto was still new to the company.
Yeah. Which is something to be said about that.
It sure is, and he will get a well-deserved Industry Lifetime Achievement Award at the DICE Awards event in Las Vegas on February 22nd. I was mistaken. It is not in March. It is February 22nd, so that is coming up very soon, but it is well-deserved all the same. But speaking of Nintendo for a moment, let's get into some other, just other tidbits of gaming news from the past several days that are certainly notable and something.
Just a few final cleanup items here.
So we saw at E3 last year during Nintendo's little vlog, infomercial, the tease of Metroid Prime 4. And I say tease because that's literally all it was. It was a graphic for Metroid Prime 4, and that's all we know about it. Just, it is a game in development. And since then, Nintendo has been very tight-lipped about it, offering nothing in terms of release date, game footage. Hell, they haven't even said who is developing the title for the Nintendo Switch. And that's been really curious because Retro Studios developed the first three games in the Metroid Prime trilogy, or what was the Metroid Prime trilogy, first two being on the GameCube, the third one coming out for the Nintendo Wii. But Eurogamer, as they are wont to do, have been able to scoop something and have learned and shared with the rest of us in the gaming world that it is, in fact, Bandai Namco Studios Singapore who are working on developing Metroid Prime 4 alongside Nintendo. But Bandai Namco doing the real legwork on this. And this would be an interesting, though not unexpected, but not unsurprising move for Nintendo to have another studio develop a Metroid Prime or Metroid game, because Metroid Other M, which you may or may not recall from the Nintendo Wii, was developed by a company other than Nintendo. It was developed by Team Ninja. Now, that one was decried for many reasons, and there weren't too many people who were fans of it, especially compared to the Prime Trilogy, but Bandai Namco, especially in the light of the recent Dragon Ball fighting game, they have a thing for action games.
Yeah, so that's something to look forward to whenever it gets more information. We still don't really have any sort of release information or anything like that, but we're getting there. There's pieces trickling out here and there, and hopefully this means something will come of this, other than just the logo for Metroid Prime that we saw during their infomercial thing.
But yes, which even looking back on it now, almost a year later, I get people are jazzed about the idea of a Metroid Prime 4, but it literally was just the logo.
Yeah.
The response seemed disproportionate to me to what was offered.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing given other than like, hey, check out what we're working on, probably. It's like, okay, fine. But, yeah, Metroid, classic franchise.
Absolutely. And if Nintendo is seemingly going guns a-blazing with releases and big releases for the Switch, there's bound to be a Metroid game, and hey, why not revisit the Metroid Prime series after Other M kinda was met with critical and commercial lackluster responses.
Right.
Although Bandai Namco developing this new Metroid Prime game makes me wonder, what the hell is Retro Studios working on?
That's a good question and something that we'll have to wait and see, I'm sure. But as I was saying, Metroid was a big franchise for Nintendo. A big-ish franchise for Sony back in the day was Spyro the Dragon. There were a few Spyro the Dragon games. Maybe it wasn't the biggest franchise of all time, but it was still relatively beloved.
I'd say it was a 1B to Crash Bandicoot at the same time, too.
Yeah, and, you know, Crash Bandicoot saw a nice shiny HD upscale remaster thing come out a couple months ago for the PlayStation 4. And it seems like Spyro is going to get a similar treatment because Activision is working on a Spyro the Dragon trilogy remaster, which will be announced in March 18 and released in the third quarter of 2018. This is according to Kotaku. So if this information turns out to be incorrect, you have them to blame. But
It's true. The report from Laura Kate Dale of Kotaku UK basically says that Activision is developing this Spyro the Dragon remastered trilogy, and they're taking a similar approach to it as they did with the Crash Bandicoot remastered trilogy, which is to say, kind of break it down and then build it back up in better parts and pieces, but still have it look very similar and feel very similar to what the Crash Band or what the original games did, I should say, which is what they did with the Crash Bandicoot games.
Yes, and in case you forgot everything about Spyro the Dragon, those three games will include Spyro the Dragon. The second one in the series was Ripto's Rage, and the third one was Year of the Dragon. And there is some very... Well, there's been the possibility teased that some content that was cut from the original releases of the three games will be included in these, so that's very interesting to look out for, but... Yeah, no solid release date, though one source did suggest to Kotaku that September might be the launch month, because that would actually coincide with the 20th anniversary of the Spyro the Dragon franchise. Believe it or not, it's a franchise that's 20 years old.
Good God, it's hard to believe that's 20 years old.
Yes, but...
From the era of character platform action games on both the PlayStation and the N64, there was everything back then, and because of the exclusivity of Spyro and Crash Bandicoot on the PlayStation, those became the most identifiable characters for the Sony PlayStation.
Yeah, them along with Lara Croft.
That's true, too. I forgot about Lara Croft.
They were sort of the triumvirate of... the major three PlayStation characters, you know, whereas Nintendo had Mario and I guess, well, Microsoft wasn't really a thing yet for gaming, but yeah, it was the closest thing to competition because, well, Sega wasn't really so much around as strong anymore, even though Sonic the Hedgehog still did poke his head up every now and then, but... Yeah, but something that all of these developers never did back in the day, at least explicitly, was pose as someone else and review their own games. Because you would think, why would you do that? That's insane. Why wouldn't you at least pay someone to review the game for you, like everyone else? Well, Incel Games never got that memo.
No, they didn't, as we move on to our last news item for this week's show. They didn't. Incel Games is a smaller game development studio. I believe they're based on the Isle of Malta. And they've released a couple titles for Steam, and they recently released a game called Wild Buster. And I guess when the game came out, sales weren't quite what the company was hoping they would be. And in no small part because the game really didn't have many reviews on its Steam page. And so what happened was the CEO of the company sent out an email to all employees and essentially said, hey, this game's not doing so well. It's not meeting projections. We need to boost its prominence and get it some more, downloads and whatnot. So you there, all like staff employees of this company who made this game, we want you to basically go buy the game and download it or review the game and to boost it that way.
Yeah.
Now, the email that the CEO sent out was leaked on Reddit, and because of all of this, Valve ultimately went and investigated and discovered that, yes, after this email went out, there was a bunch of positive reviews for Wild Buster that suddenly came to its Steam page. And as a result, Valve doesn't mess around, and so they didn't just take the reviews down, they didn't just take the game down, they took down the entire game library from the company.
Yeah. So... they pulled a Twin Galaxies with Todd Rogers with, incel games. Though, interestingly enough, incel games' Patrick Streppel actually confirmed that he did write the letter and said that the company plans to appeal the decision to Valve. So, he's admitting guilt, but for some reason is going to try to appeal it somehow?
Yeah, it's like saying, okay, yeah, I did it, but here's why it was okay and doesn't break the regulations you've set out.
Yeah. I know you have all these laws and it's like, I know you have all these laws about speeding, officer, but I figured they didn't apply to me because I was drunk. Does that sound reasonable to say? No, of course it doesn't. What do you, like,
it's a ballsy and bold move the CEO of Incel Games is taking. And
unfortunately, as a gamble, he lost all of his money. He crapped out the table. That's what happened.
See, so when that happens, you appeal to the casino and say, no, no, he actually won. And that's how you get your money back.
I know I gave you the mortgage to my house, but hey, my wife will be mad. Like, yeah, okay, cool. You still gave the mortgage to your house away, or you gave the deed to your house away, you idiot. But,
So in reading around the internet on this story, which is a pretty wild story, it's entertaining and hilarious because, the CEO of Incel Games is clearly unscrupulous and also just out of touch. Shouldn't have, it may have been mentioned to him that, like, you can't really do this on Steam because that's, well, against Steam regulations and there's going to be consequences. He may have ignored that entirely, but, I came across the, a news item about this on Gamasutra.com, and in reading the comments of that Gamasutra news item on this story, one of the posters on there actually confirmed their identity as being, or stated their identity as being the source of this leak to Reddit and said, the company has been warned before. They had a game pulled previously in 2015 for something similar, so this is actually a second or third offense for something along the same lines, hence why the entire game library was pulled from the developer.
So it's not like, you know, a brand new thing. And also, I would imagine that that developer who leaked, or that person that leaked the stuff on Reddit, is probably looking for a new job, I would imagine.
I'd imagine so, and in no small part because if the company was, did this before, was warned, and suffered some consequence after that initial time, and yet had the gall to do it again, is that really a place you want to work anyway?
Yeah, I mean, sounds sketchy to me. But hey.
It does, and also the email that the CEO sent out was threatening without being threatening. It basically made it sound like if the employees didn't go out to, you know, buy the game from Steam, download it, or leave positive reviews for it, the company could go under and they'd be out of jobs. So under that almost not such threat, yes, obviously several employees took this up and did it, and here's the result. Now you have no games on Steam. So where'd that get you?
Yeah, so congratulations, you now have no revenue stream, and you're done as a company. Perfect. RIP Incel Games, whatever year to 2018.
Now, this brings up the other issue that there always is with Steam and releasing games to Steam, but just the absolute dearth of product and content that's released on there. I don't know how the hell you get your game to stand out.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it's a dark science that, thankfully, I don't have to know about. I'm not in that whole realm, and I would imagine that it would be a very cutthroat one to be in.
Certainly so, and if you're releasing a game on the Steam platform, you're basically just pouring a cup of water into the ocean.
Yeah, and if you're not doing it for fun, and just, you know, like, if you're doing it to try to, you know, get big, that seems to be the wrong reason, And it almost seems like indie games on Steam are now sort of almost like reached the same point as like bands that have independent albums out in the real world. There's hundreds of thousands of bands out there in the real world releasing hundreds of thousands of albums. There's way too much music out there as well. How do you stand out? I don't know. Hopefully you go viral on YouTube or something, maybe.
Yeah, that's seemingly the only way, with anything like that. But, let that be a lesson out there. If you are thinking of doing that, on Steam, don't. Valve does not mess around.
No, they don't. They will bring the hammer down and they will bring it down hard.
And rightfully so. That is their platform. They, do their best to, adjudicate it properly within the realms of their own rules and regulations. But, perhaps one day we'll be speaking of Wild Buster as a blast from the past. I doubt it. But I just needed to say that to transition to the blast from the past as we get to the final segment of the program, the portion of the show where we find some pieces of media entertainment that are celebrating milestone anniversaries. And this week we have found two movies. One is 15 years old. It's kind of wild to think that it's 15 years old, and the other is 25 years old. One is a really, really good classic comedy that's developed an even bigger cult following with age and the internet. And the other is very much a product of the time it was made in.
Yeah, I think we can talk about that one first, because I think when this movie came out, I remember Mike the Legend and I actually did go to see it in the theater, and we walked out of it going, what the hell was that crap? It was awful. Like a terrible version of a character written using such heavy-handed, awful, ham-fisted tropes. Just generally bad acting, just kind of generally boring, unlikable characterizations. And it's actually surprising that Marvel Studios was actually able to kind of claw it back and actually make something good of it years later on Netflix. And you might have figured out what we're talking about. We're talking about Daredevil.
That's right. The movie that came out on February 14th, 2003 with Ben Affleck starring as Matt Murdock / Daredevil, the protector of Hell's Kitchen, also starring Jennifer Garner as Elektra, Colin Farrell as Bullseye, and Michael Clark Duncan as the Kingpin in what many people at the time felt was a radical departure to cast Michael Clark Duncan as Kingpin, given that in the comics, Kingpin is white, but Michael Clark Duncan is an African-American.
I mean, if anything else, I thought that was the only cool thing about the movie. The characterization of Kingpin, maybe the most memorable thing about the movie.
And, I mean, Michael Clark Duncan was good as Kingpin.
Yeah.
Like as good as he could be in that movie.
Yeah. But even Michael Clark Duncan, the late Michael Clark Duncan, I should say, could not save that pile of garbage of a movie.
No, and this movie has not gotten better with age. It has not been reviewed with new eyes by really anyone to put it in a glowing light, or at least a not as harsh light. It is still considered a hot mess of a movie. Now let's go back to 2003, and let's remember that's still the era of early comic book movies.
Yeah, they were still sort of in unproven ground. I want to say that X-Men was kind of just came out.
I think X-Men 2 had just kind of come out around that time.
Yeah,
or was around that time, but Blade was still the first big Marvel movie franchise.
Right.
Or first big movie franchise of a Marvel comic book character. Spider-Man had just come out the year before, the first of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies. And because of the success of those, of Spider-Man and X-Men, there was just a rush of movie studios to get in on the comic book movie craze. And one of the movies that got cranked out in that rush for what people thought was a gold mine was Daredevil. And I don't know if there's anything redeemable about this movie.
No, I mean, I seem to recall at the time, I one of us made the comment to each other about, like, wow, they sure overused rain anytime there was a fight sequence, almost like they kind of misunderstood the extent of Matt Murdock's powers, where it was almost like you need to see the rain and just to basically to help you visualize how he sees things. Even though he didn't need rain or anything to hear, he could just, he had crazy hearing. That was the whole thing about his character. But, and because he was blind, obviously, in case you're not aware of the Daredevil character, he's blind, as a result, has super hearing, blah, blah, blah. But every single time any sort of dramatic thing happened, it was in the rain, which just seemed very weird and unnecessary.
It did, especially towards the end, where I think there's a big emotional moment between Daredevil and Elektra, and of course Daredevil cannot actually see Elektra, but as they're going through this moment, it begins to rain. And you see the visualization on screen of the rain kind of hitting Jennifer Garner's face and forming her image on the screen in the rain, but it's almost like sonar it becomes, and it's so stupid.
Yeah, it really is. But, yeah, don't know if I can necessarily recommend this movie, but if you are a fan of the Daredevil TV series, which it's good, it's a great TV series, it's worth going back and seeing what they tried to do 15 years ago before, you know, they let good people at some of these properties.
It's a very interesting time capsule of the moment of what happens when you have people who maybe aren't passionate about the source material or about the work they're doing in a comic book movie. And we saw this also, too, a couple of years later when the Fantastic Four movies came out.
Yep.
So that's kind of what happens. And let's be clear, I mean, it's a Marvel character, this Daredevil movie. It's a Marvel character, but Marvel had nothing to do with the movie. This was a Fox movie back in the day, and in the years since, Marvel regained the entertainment rights to the Daredevil character, and thus the Netflix TV series.
Yeah. But,
So yeah, Daredevil. Total hot mess.
Yeah, but to contrast Daredevil, 25 years ago, an absolute comedy classic was released, directed, produced, written, screenplay by the late, great Harold Ramis, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell and Chris Elliott, Groundhog Day. If you've never seen Groundhog Day, you need to see Groundhog Day right now. If you are a fan of good comedy, if you're a fan of Bill Murray, which why wouldn't you be a fan of Bill Murray? It's one of the absolute must-see comedy classics, in my opinion.
I think it's also safe to say it's one of the more bizarre concepts for a movie that then went on to become such a revered and classic comedy.
Yeah, it's a super weird concept. A man trapped in Groundhog Day, waking up and living the same day over and over and over again until he finally figures out why he's trapped in the day and what he's supposed to be doing with his life, and like basically makes him question all the decisions that he's made and all of this stuff. And like, few movies I feel that have a weird concept like this kind of pull off their weird concept as well as Groundhog Day does. And that's to say that, the elevator pitch of the movie, the 5-second here's all you need to know, is that, yeah, Bill Murray's character wakes up over and over and over again, except by the end of the movie, you actually really feel and see how long it's been going on for him by. And they did a really good job of, or Harold Ramis, I should say, really did a good job of driving that home. And other movies with weird concepts like this, I don't know if they do as good of a job driving their weird concept home. Like, it's more like a, oh, I get the concept, fine, but you don't actually feel how well done it is. You know, like, someone actually went to the trouble at some point to do the math of Groundhog Day, and it actually is kind of crazy when they figure how many times he relived the same day, but I don't have it on hand here at the moment, but it was something like, by the end of the movie, you actually see all the different things he's mastered, like piano, ice sculpting, among other things. And they figure, like, if you use the Malcolm McDowell 10,000 hours thing to become an expert in something, of all the different things that he's become an expert in, I think the math worked out to be something like 90 years. He's been living the same day over and over again. So, and that's not even counting all of like the time that he might have spent, you know, just trying to kill himself or do what other weird things. And like, at this point, if you've never seen the movie, you should probably stop listening to this and just go watch the movie. And you might be thinking, wait, what the hell are you talking about? Kill himself? Learn to play piano? What? What kind of movie is this? But it's, yeah, it, like, I don't know. I've seen this movie more times than I can recall. And it's one of those movies where if it's ever on, I'll watch it right to the end, no matter what point in the movie it is. And I'll actually try to go out of my way every now and then to see this movie. It's classic.
It's a bizarre concept for a movie where it could have easily just been a one-note comedy.
Yeah.
But having, I guess, the layer of emotional depth there is to the story, and also having Bill Murray in there helps tremendously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bill Murray just has, like, he might not be the best actor in the world, but damn if he doesn't have some of the best charisma out of anyone.
Oh, God. And he's just entertaining in almost anything he does.
Yeah.
And not necessarily movie-wise, but within the context of this movie, whatever he does, you are interested to watch and see where it goes. And, I mean, the premise of the movie, too, is that he's a big-time, you know, big-city reporter sent to podunk rural Pennsylvania for the annual groundhog, being pulled from its hole to see whether or not it saw its shadow or not, and to predict how many more weeks of winter.
Yeah, to see if Punxsutawney Phil sees his shadow. Or sorry, Punxsutawney Pete. If I recall correctly, Phil was the name of Bill Murray's character. But yeah, it's fantastic. I can't even solidify into proper words how much I love this movie. It's an incredible comedy. It's got all of like the classic old school SCTV, old SNL, all of like that time of comedies kind of stuff coalesced into it, very much in the same way that it did for Stripes or like Ghostbusters or Animal House or anything like this. It's, if you're a fan of any of those movies and have not seen Groundhog Day, you should see Groundhog Day. That's all I'll say.
In all these years that have passed since the movie was released and the number of times I've seen it and whatnot, one of the things that just strikes me and I've always found odd is the mechanic, why he's stuck reliving this day and how it happens is never explained. It's not hinted at. It is not winked at. There's nary a mention made of what's driving him and what is keeping him in this day. What has brought him to relive this day over and over. How he is being made to relive it over and over. It's just a thing that happens.
Yep. And that's,
it
that's
still
fine.
Works.
Yeah, it still works. It's fine. But, yeah, it's... Yeah, can't quite put my finger on it, but all I know is that I love this movie, and that's all I have to say.
And that's all you really need to say, because you're not alone in that fact. So many people out there on the internet have really come to love this movie since that time, and hopefully you will love the movie as well when you go and watch it, either for the first time or again and again and again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Groundhog Day celebrating its 25th anniversary this week. And before that, we spoke of Daredevil. Just as an interesting contrast point, the movie was to the current Netflix series, the movie celebrating its 15th anniversary this week, having been released on Valentine's Day 2003, and so you can go back and see a younger Ben Affleck in a terrible superhero movie.
Yeah.
Because older Ben Affleck has a couple of those too.
He sure does. It's the story of his life.
Bookended in superhero movies.
Yes.
But that about wraps us up for this week's edition of The Arcade. We thank you so much for joining us and hope you will join us once again next week. We want to hear your thoughts on either Groundhog Day, Daredevil. Are you actually somebody who enjoyed the Daredevil movie? Let us know. Email us info@thearcadeshow.com, or you can send us a message. Follow us on Twitter @TheArcadeShow. And on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. And we look forward to you joining us once again, as we'll be back again with you in 7 days hence. So until then, good night, everybody.
Good night.